Chapter 21. The Cards of Marseille. February 1808. The alehouse was called the Pineapple, and had once been the refuge and hiding place of a notorious thief and murderer. This thief had had an enemy, a man as bad as himself. The thief and his enemy had been partners in some dreadful crime, but the thief had kept both shares of the spoils and sent a message to the magistrates telling them where his enemy might be found. As soon as the enemy had escaped from Newgate, he had come to the Pineapple in the dead of night with 30 men. He had set them to tear the slates off the roof and unpick the very bricks of the walls until he could reach inside and pluck out the thief. No one had seen what happened next, but many had heard the dreadful screams issuing from the pitch-black street. The landlord had discovered that the Pineapple's dark reputation was good for business, and consequently he had never troubled to mend his house, other than by applying timber and pitch to the holes, which gave it the appearance of wearing bandages, as if it had been fighting with its neighbours. Three greasy steps led down from the street door into a gloomy parlour. The Pineapple had its own particular perfume, compounded of ale, tobacco, the natural fragrance of the customers, and the unholy stink of the Fleet River, which had been used as a sewer for countless years. The Fleet ran beneath the Pineapple's foundations, and the Pineapple was generally supposed to be sinking into it. The walls of the parlour were ornamented with cheap engravings, portraits of famous criminals of the last century who had all been hanged, and portraits of the king's dissolute sons who had not been hanged yet. Childermas and Vinculus sat down at a table in a corner. A shadowy girl brought a cheap tallow candle and two pewter tankards of hot spiced ale. Childermas paid. They drank in silence a while, and then Vinculus looked up at Childermas.
"What was all that nonsense about bonnets and princesses?"
Childermas laughed.
"Oh, that was just a notion I had. Ever since the day you appeared in his library, my master has been petitioning all his great friends to help him destroy you. He asked Lord Hawkesbury and Sir Walter Pole to complain to the king on his behalf. I believe he had an idea that His Majesty might send the army to make war upon you. But Lord Hawkesbury and Sir Walter said that the king was unlikely to put himself to a great deal of trouble over one yellow-curtained, ragged-assed sorcerer. But it occurred to me that if His Majesty were to learn that you had somehow threatened the virgin state of his daughters, he might take a different view of the matter."
Footnote 1. The king was a most loving and devoted father to his six daughters, but his affection was such that it led him to act almost as if he were their jailer. He could not bear the thought that any of them might marry and leave him. They were required to leave lives of quite intolerable dullness with the ill-tempered queen at Windsor Castle. Out of the six, only one contrived to get married before she was 40. Childermas took another draught of his spiced ale.
"But tell me, Vinculus, don't you tire of fake spells and pretend oracles? Half your customers come to laugh at you. They no more believe in your magic than you do. Your day is over. There's a real magician in England now."
Vinculus gave a little snort of disgust.
"The magician of Hanover Square. All the great men in London sit telling one another that they never saw a man so honest. But I know magicians, and I know magic. And I say this, all magicians lie, and this one more than most."
Childermas shrugged, as if he would not trouble to deny it. Vinculus leaned forward across the table.
"Magic shall be written on the faces of the stony hills, but their minds shall not be able to contain it. In winter the barren trees shall be a black writing, but they shall not understand it."
"Trees and hills, Vinculus. When did you last see a tree or a hill? Why don't you say that magic is written on the faces of the dirty houses, or that the smoke writes magic in the sky?"
"It's not my prophecy."
"Ah, yes, of course. You claim it as a prophecy of the Raven King. Well, there's nothing unusual in that. Every charlatan I ever met was the bearer of a message from the Raven King." "I sit upon a black throne in the shadows,"
muttered Vinculus.
"But they shall not see me. The rain shall make a door for me, and I shall pass through it."
"Quite. So since you didn't write this prophecy yourself, where did you find it?"
For a moment Vinculus looked as if he wouldn't answer, but then he said,
"It is written in a book."
"A book? What book? My master's library is extensive. He knows of no such prophecy."
Vinculus said nothing.
Is it your book? Asked Childermas.
It is in my keeping.
And where did you get a book? Where did you steal it?
I did not steal it. It's my inheritance. It is the greatest glory and the greatest burden that has been given to any man in this age.
If it is really valuable, then you can sell it to Norrell. He has paid great prices for books before now.
The magician of Hanover Square will never own this book. He will never even see it.
And where do you keep such a great treasure?
Vinculus laughed coldly, as if to say it was not very likely that he would tell that to the servant of his enemy. Childermas called to the girl to bring them some more ale. She brought it, and they drank for a while longer in silence. Then Childermas took a pack of cards from the breast of his coat and showed them to Vinculus.
The cards of Marseille. Did you ever see their like before?
Often,
said Vinculus.
But yours are different. They are copies of a set belonging to a sailor I met in Whitby. He bought them in Genoa with the intention of using them to discover the hiding places of pirates' gold. But when he came to look at them, he found that he could not understand them. He offered to sell them to me, but I was poor and could not pay the price he asked. So we struck a bargain. I would tell him his fortune, and in return he would lend me the cards long enough to make copies. Unfortunately, his ship set sail before I was able to complete the drawings, and so half are done from memory.
And what fortune did you tell him?
His true one, that he would be drowned dead before the year was out.
Vinculus laughed approvingly. It seemed that when Childermas had made the bargain with the dead sailor, he had been too poor even to afford paper, and so the cards were drawn upon the backs of alehouse bills, laundry lists, letters, old accounts and playbills. At a later date, he had pasted the papers onto coloured cardboard, but in several instances, the printing or writing on the other side showed through, giving them an odd look. Childermas laid out 9 cards in a line. He turned over the first card. Beneath the picture was a number and a name. 9.
L'Ermite.
It showed an old man in a monkish robe with a monkish hood. He carried a lantern and walked with a stick, as if he'd come near to losing the use of his limbs through too much sitting and studying. His face was pinched and suspicious. A dry atmosphere seemed to rise up and envelop the observer, as if the card itself were peppery with dust.
Said Childermas. For the present, your actions are governed by a hermit. Well, we knew that already.
The next card was Le Mât, which is the only picture card to remain numberless, as if the character it depicts is in some sense outside the story. Childermas's card showed a man walking along a road beneath a summer tree. He had a stick to lean upon, and another stick over his shoulder, with a handkerchief bundle hanging from it. A little dog skipped after him. The figure was intended to represent the fool or jester of ancient times. He had a bell in his hat and ribbons at his knees, which Childermas had coloured red and green. It appeared that Childermas did not know quite how to interpret this card. He considered a while, and then turned over the next 2 cards. 8. La Justice. A crowned woman holding a sword and a pair of scales. And the 2 of Wands. The wands were crossed, and might, among other things, be thought to represent a crossroads. Childermas let out a brief burst of laughter.
Well, well,
he said, crossing his arms and regarding Vinculus with some amusement.
This card here,
he tapped La Justice,
tells me you have weighed your choices and come to a decision. And this one,
he indicated the 2 of Wands,
tells me what your decision is. You're going wandering. It seems I've wasted my time. You have already made up your mind to leave London. So many protestations, Vinculus, and yet you always intended to go.
Vinculus shrugged, as if to say, what did Childermas expect? The 5th card was the Valet de Coupe, the Page of Cups. One naturally thinks of a page as being a youthful person, but the picture showed a mature man with bowed head. His hair was shaggy and his beard was thick. In his left hand he carried a heavy cup, yet it could not be that which gave such an odd, strained expression to his countenance, not unless it were the heaviest cup in the world. No, it must be some other burden, not immediately apparent. Owing to the materials which Childermas had been compelled to use to construct his cards, this picture had a most peculiar look. It had been drawn upon the back of a letter, and the writing showed through the paper. The man's clothes were a mass of scribble, and even his face and hands bore parts of letters. Vinculus laughed when he saw it, as though he recognized it. He gave the card three taps in friendly greeting. Perhaps it was this that made Childemas less certain than he had been before. "You have a message to deliver to someone?" he said in an uncertain tone. Vinculus nodded.
"And will the next card show me this person?"
he asked. "Yes."
"Ah,"
exclaimed Vinculus, and turned over the sixth card himself. The sixth card was the Cavalier de Baton, the Knight of Wands. A man in a broad-brimmed hat sat upon a horse of a pale colour. The countryside through which he rode was indicated by a few rocks and tufts of grass at his horse's hooves. His clothes were well-made and expensive-looking, but for some inexplicable reason he was carrying a heavy club. Even to call it a club was to make it sound grander than it was. It was scarcely more than a thick branch torn from a tree or hedge. There were still twigs and leaves protruding from it. Vinculus picked up the card and studied it carefully. The seventh card was the Two of Swords. Childemas said nothing, but immediately turned over the eighth card. Le Pendu, the Hanged Man. The ninth card was Le Monde, the World. It showed a naked female figure dancing. In the four corners of the card were an angel, an eagle, a winged bull, and a winged lion, the symbol of the evangelists. "You may expect a meeting," said Childemas, "leading to an ordeal of some sort, perhaps even death. The cards do not say whether you survive or not, but whatever happens, this," he touched the last card, "says that you will achieve your purpose."
"And do you know what I am now?" asked Vinculus.
"Not exactly, but I know more of you than I did."
"You see that I am not like the others," said Vinculus.
"There's nothing here that says you're anything more than a charlatan," said Childemas, and he began to collect his cards.
"Wait," said Vinculus. "I will tell your fortune."
Vinculus took the cards and laid out nine. Then he turned them over one by one. 18, La Lune. 16, La Maison Dieu, reversed. The Nine of Swords, Valet de Baton, the Ten of Batons, reversed. 2, La Papesse. 10, La Rove de Fortune, the Two of Coins, the King of Cups. Vinculus looked at them. He picked up La Maison Dieu and examined it, but he said nothing at all. Childemas laughed.
"You're right, Vinculus. You're not like the others. That is my life, there on the table. But you cannot read it. You're a strange creature, the very reverse of all the magicians of the last centuries. They were full of learning but had no talent. You have talent and no knowledge. You cannot profit by what you see."
Vinculus scratched his long sallow cheek with his unclean fingernails. Childemas began again to gather up his cards, but once again Vinculus prevented him and indicated that they should lay out the cards again. "What?" asked Childemas in surprise.
"I've told you your fortune. You've failed to tell me mine. What more is there?"
"I'm going to tell his fortune."
"Whose? Norrell's? But you will not understand it."
"Shuffle the cards," said Vinculus stubbornly.
So Childemas shuffled the cards, and Vinculus took nine and laid them out. Then he turned over the first card. 4. L'Empereur. It showed a king seated upon a throne in the open air with all the customary kingly accoutrements of crown and scepter. Childemas leaned forward and examined it.
"What is it?"
asked Vinculus.
"I do not seem to have copied this card very well. I never noticed before. The inking is badly done. The lines are thick and smudged, so that the emperor's hair and robe appear almost black, and someone has left a dirty thumbprint over the eagle. The emperor should be an older man than this. I have drawn a young man. Are you going to hazard an interpretation?"
"No,"
said Vinculus, and indicated by a contemptuous thrust of his chin that Childemas should turn the next card. 4. L'Empereur. There was a short silence.
That is not possible, said Childemas. There are not two emperors in this pack. I know there are not.
If anything, the king was younger and fiercer than before. His hair and robes were black, and the crown upon his head had become a thin band of pale metal. There was no trace of the thumbprint upon the card, but the great bird in the corner was now decidedly black, and it had cast off its eagle-like aspects and settled itself into a shape altogether more English. It had become a raven. Childemas turned over the third card. Four, l'Empereur. And the fourth, four, l'Empereur. By the fifth, the number and the name of the card had disappeared, but the picture remained the same. A young, dark-haired king at whose feet strutted a great black bird. Childemas turned over each and every card. He even examined the remainder of the pack, but in his anxiety to see, he fumbled and the card somehow fell everywhere. Black kings crowded about Childemas, spinning in the cold grey air. Upon each card was the same figure with the same pale, unforgiving gaze.
There, said Vinculus softly. That is what you may tell the magician of Hanover Square. That is his past and his present and his future.
Needless to say, when Childemas returned to Hanover Square and told Mr. Norrell what had occurred, Mr. Norrell was very angry. That Vinculus should continue to defy Mr. Norrell was bad enough. That he should claim to have a book and Mr. Norrell not be able to read it was considerably worse. But that he should pretend to tell Mr. Norrell's fortune and threaten him with pictures of black kings was absolutely unbearable.
He tricked you, declared Mr. Norrell angrily. He hid your own cards and supplanted them with a deck of his own. I'm amazed you were so taken in.
Quite, agreed Mr. Lascelles, regarding Childemas coldly. Oh, to be sure, Vinculus is nothing but conjuring tricks, agreed Drawlight. But still, I should have liked to have seen it.
I'm as fond as anything of Vinculus. I wish you'd told me, Mr. Childemas, that you were going to see him. I would have come with you.
Childemas ignored Lascelles and Drawlight and addressed Mr. Norrell. Even supposing that he is able enough a conjurer to perform such a trick, which I'm very far from allowing, how is he to know I possessed such a thing as a pack of Marseille cards? How is he to know when you did not?
Aye, and it was as well for you that I did not know. Telling fortunes with picture cards, it is everything I despise. Oh, it has been a very ill-managed business from start to finish.
And what of this book that the sorcerer claims to have? Asked Lascelles.
Yes, indeed, said Mr. Norrell. That odd prophecy. I dare say it is nothing, yet there were one or two expressions which suggested great antiquity. I believe it would be best if I examined that book.
Well, Mr. Childemas? Asked Lascelles. I do not know where he keeps it.
Then we suggest you find out.
So Childemas set spies to follow Vinculus, and the first and most surprising discovery they made was that Vinculus was married. Indeed, he was a great deal more married than most people. His wives were five in number, and they were scattered throughout the various parishes of London and the surrounding towns and villages. The eldest was 45, and the youngest 15, and each was entirely ignorant of the existence of the other four. Childemas contrived to meet with each of them in turn. To two of them, he appeared in the character of the unlikely milliner. To another, he presented himself as a customs officer. For the benefit of the fourth, he became a drunken, gambling rogue. And he told the fifth that though he appeared to the world to be a servant of the great Mr. Norrell of Hanover Square, he was in secret a magician himself. Two tried to rob him. One said she would tell him anything he wanted to know, as long as he paid for her gin. One tried to make him go with her to a Methodist prayer meeting. And the fifth, much to everyone's surprise, fell in love with him. But in the end, all his play-acting was for nothing, because none of them were even aware that Vinculus possessed such a thing as a book, let alone where he kept it. Mr. Norrell refused to believe this, and in his private study on the second floor, he cast spells and peered into a silver dish of water, examining the lodgings of Vinculus's five wives, but nowhere was there anything resembling a book. Meanwhile, on the floor above, in a little room set aside for his own particular use, Childemas laid out his cards. The cards had all returned to their original form, except for the Emperor, who had not shaken off his raven-kingish look. Certain cards appeared over and over again, among them the Ace of Cups, an ecclesiastical-looking chalice of such elaborate design that it more resembled a walled city on a stalk. And, too, La Papesse. According to Childemas's way of thinking, both these cards stood for something hidden. The suit of wands also appeared with quite unwanted frequency, but they were always in the higher numbers, the 7, the 8, the 9, and 10. The more Childemas gazed at these rows of wands, the more they appeared to him to be lines of writing. Yet at the same time, they were a barrier, an obstacle to understanding, and so Childemas came to believe that Vincula's book, whatever it was in an unknown language. Chapter 22. The Knight of Wands. February 1808. Jonathan Strange was a very different sort of person from his father. He was not avaricious, he was not proud, he was not ill-tempered and disagreeable. But though he had no striking vices, his virtues were perhaps almost as hard to define. At the pleasure parties of Weymouth and in the drawing rooms of Bath, he was regularly declared to be the most charming man in the world by the fashionable people he met there. But all that they meant by this was that he talked well, danced well, and hunted and gambled as much as a gentleman should. In person, he was rather tall, and his figure was considered good. Some people thought him handsome, but this was not by any means the universal opinion. His face had two faults, a long nose and an ironic expression. It is also true that his hair had a reddish tinge, and as everybody knows, no one with red hair can ever truly be said to be handsome. At the time of his father's death, he was much taken up with a scheme to persuade a certain young lady to marry him. When he arrived home from Shrewsbury on the day of his father's death, and the servants told him the news, his first thoughts were to wonder how his suit would be affected. Was she more likely to say yes now, or less? This marriage ought to have been the easiest matter in the world to arrange. Their friends all approved the match, and the lady's brother, her only relation, was scarcely less ardent in wishing for it than Jonathan Strange himself. True, Lawrence Strange had objected strongly to the lady's poverty, but he had put it out of his power to make any serious difficulty when he froze himself to death. But though Jonathan Strange had been the acknowledged suitor of this young lady for some months, the engagement, hourly expected by all their acquaintance, did not follow. It was not that she didn't love him. He was quite certain that she did. But sometimes it seemed as if she had fallen in love with him for the sole purpose of quarrelling with him. He was quite at a loss to account for it. He believed that he had done everything she wanted in the way of reforming his behaviour. His card playing and other sorts of gambling had dwindled away almost to nothing, and he drank very little now, scarcely more than a bottle a day. He had told her that he had no objection to going to church more, if that would please her, as often say as once a week, twice, if she would like it better. But she said that she would leave such matters to his own conscience, that they were not the sort of thing that could be dictated by another person. He knew that she disliked his frequent visits to Bath, Brighton, Weymouth, and Cheltenham, and he assured her that she had nothing to fear from the women in those places. Doubtless they were very charming, but they were nothing to him. She said that that was not what concerned her. That had not even occurred to her. It was just that she wished he could find a better way to occupy his time. She did not mean to moralize, and no one loved a holiday better than her. But perpetual holidays? Was that really what he wanted? Did that make him happy? He told her that he quite agreed with her, and in the past year he had continually been forming plans to take up this or that profession or regular train of study. The plans themselves were very good. He thought he might seek out a destitute poetic genius and become his patron. He thought he would study law, or look for fossils on the beach at Lyme Regis, buy an ironworks, study iron founding, ask a fellow he knew about new methods of agriculture, study theology, and finish reading a fascinating work on engineering, which he was almost certain he had put down on a little table at the furthest corner of his father's library 2 or 3 years ago. But to each of these projected courses, some formidable obstacle was found to exist. Destitute poetic geniuses were harder to come by than he'd imagined. Footnote 1. It appears that Strange did not abandon the notion of a poetical career easily. In the life of Jonathan Strange, publisher John Murray, London, 1820, John Segundus describes how, having been disappointed in his search for a poet, Strange decided to write the poems himself. Things went very well upon the first day. From breakfast to dinner, he sat in his dressing gown, at the little writing table in his dressing room, and scribbled very fast upon several dozen sheets of quarto. He was very delighted with everything he wrote, and so was his valet, who was a literary man himself, and who gave advice upon the knotty questions of metaphor and rhetoric, and who ran about gathering up the papers as they flew about the room and putting them in order, and then running downstairs to read the most exhilarating parts to his friend, the under-gardener. It really was astonishing how quickly Strange wrote. Indeed, the valet declared that when he put his hand close to Strange's head, he could feel a heat coming off it, because of the immense creative energies within. On the second day, Strange sat down to write another 50 or so pages, and immediately got into difficulties, because he could not think of a rhyme for "let love suffice." Sunk in vice was not promising, a pair of mice was nonsense, and what's the price, merely vulgar. He struggled for an hour, could think of nothing, went for a ride to loosen his brains, and never looked at his poem again. Law books were dull. He could not remember the name of the fellow who knew about agriculture, and the day that he intended to start for Lyme Regis, it was raining heavily. And so on and so on. He told the young lady that he heartily wished that he had gone into the Navy years ago. Nothing in the world would have suited him so well, but his father would never have agreed to it, and he was 28 now. It was far too late to take up a naval career. The name of this curiously dissatisfied young woman was Arabella Woodhope, and she was the daughter of the late curate of St. Swithin's in Clunbury. Footnote 2. A village 5 or 6 miles from Strange's home. At the time of Lawrence Strange's death, she was paying an extended visit to some friends in the Gloucestershire village where her brother was a curate. A letter of condolence reached Strange on the morning of the funeral. It expressed everything that was proper. Sympathy for his loss, tempered by an understanding of the elder Mr. Strange's many failings as a parent. But there was something more besides. She was concerned about him. She regretted her absence from Shropshire. She did not like him being alone and friendless at such a time. His mind was made up upon the instant. He could not imagine that he was ever likely to find himself in a more advantageous situation. She would never be more full of anxious tenderness than she was at this moment, and he would never be richer. He could not quite believe that she was as indifferent to his wealth as she claimed. He supposed he ought to allow a proper interval between his father's funeral and his proposal of marriage. 3 days seemed about right, so on the morning of the fourth day, he ordered his valet to pack his clothes and his groom to make his horse ready, and he set off for Gloucestershire. He took with him the new manservant. He had spoken at length to this man and found him to be energetic, resourceful, and able. The new manservant was delighted to be chosen, though his vain spirit told him that this was the most natural thing in the world. But now that the new manservant had passed the giant toppling stage of his career, now that he has, as it were, stepped out of myth and into the workaday world, it will perhaps be found more convenient to give him his name like an ordinary mortal. His name was Jeremy Johns. Upon the first day, they endured nothing but the commonplace adventures which befall any traveller. They quarrelled with a man who set his dog to bark at them for no reason, and there was an alarm about Strange's horse, which began to show signs of being sickly, and which then, upon further investigation, was discovered to be in perfect health. On the morning of the second day, they were riding through a pretty landscape of gently sloping hills, winter woods, and prosperous-looking tidy farms. Jeremy Johns was occupied in practicing the correct degree of haughtiness for the servant of a gentleman newly come into extensive property. And Jonathan Strange was thinking about Miss Woodhope. Now that the day had arrived, when he was to see her again, he began to have some doubts of his reception. He was glad to think she was with her brother, dear good Henry, who saw nothing but good in the match, and who, Strange was quite certain, never failed to encourage his sister to think favourably of it. But he had some doubts about the friends with whom she was staying. They were a clergyman and his wife. He knew nothing of them, but he had the natural distrust that a young, rich, self-indulgent man feels for members of the clergy. Who could say what notions of extraordinary virtue and unnecessary self-sacrifice they might be daily imparting to her. The low sun cast immense shadows. Ice and frost sparkled upon the branches of the trees and in the hollows of the fields. Catching sight of a man ploughing a field, he was reminded of the families who lived upon his land and whose welfare had always been cause for concern to Miss Woodhope. An ideal conversation began to develop in his head. "And what are your intentions regarding your tenants?" she would ask. "Intentions?" he would say. "Yes," she would say. "How will you ease their burdens? Your father took every penny he could from them. He made their lives miserable." "I know he did," Strange would say. "I have never defended my father's actions." "Have you lowered the rents yet?" she would say. "Have you talked to the parish council? Have you thought about almshouses for the old people, and a school for the children?" "It is really quite unreasonable for her to be talking of rents, almshouses, and a school," thought Strange gloomily. "After all, my father only died last Tuesday." "Well, that is odd," remarked Jeremy Johns.
"Hmm?"
said Strange. He discovered that they had halted at a white gate. At the side of the road was a neat little white-painted cottage. It was newly built, and had six sides and Gothic windows. "Where is the tollkeeper?" asked Jeremy Johns.
"Hmm?"
said Strange.
"Well, it is a toll house, sir. See, there is the board with the list of money to pay. But there's no one about. Shall I leave them sixpence?"
Yes, as you wish." So Jeremy Johns left the toll upon the doorstep of the cottage and opened the gate so that Strange and he could pass through. 100 yards further on, they entered a village. There was an ancient stone church with winter's golden light upon it, an avenue of ancient twisted hornbeams that led somewhere or other, and 20 or so neat stone cottages with smoke rising up from their chimneys. A stream ran by the side of the road. It was bordered by dry yellow grasses with pendants of ice hanging from them.
"Where are all the people?" said Jeremy.
"What?" said Strange. He looked around and saw two little girls looking out of a cottage window.
"There," he said. "No, sir, those are children. I meant grown-ups. I do not see any."
This was true. There were none to be seen. There were some chickens strutting about, a cat sitting on some straw in an ancient cart, and some horses in a field. But no people. Yet as soon as Strange and Jeremy Johns left the village, the reason for this queer state of affairs became apparent. 100 yards or so from the last house in the village, a crowd was gathered around a winter hedge. They carried an assortment of weapons, billhooks, sickles, sticks, and guns. It was a very odd picture, both sinister and a little ridiculous. Anyone would have thought that the village had decided to make war upon hawthorn bushes and elder trees. The low winter sun shone full upon the villagers, gilding their clothes and weapons and their strange, intent expressions. Long, blue shadows streamed behind them. They were completely silent. Whenever one of them moved, he did so with great care, as though afraid of making a noise. As they rode by, Strange and Jeremy stood up in the stirrups and craned their necks to catch a glimpse of whatever it was that the villagers were looking at.
"Oh, that is odd," exclaimed Jeremy when they were past. "There was nothing there."
"No," said Strange. "There was a man. I'm not surprised you could not see him. At first I took him for a hedge root, but it was definitely a man, a grey, gaunt, weather-worn man, a man remarkably like a hedge root, but a man nevertheless." The road led them into a dark winter wood. Jeremy John's curiosity had been excited, and he wondered who the man could be and what the villagers were intending to do with him. Strange answered once or twice at random, but soon fell to thinking of Miss Woodhope. "It will be best to avoid discussing the changes brought on by my father's death," he thought. "It is altogether too dangerous. I will begin with light, indifferent subjects. The adventures of this journey, for example. Now, what has happened that will amuse her?" He looked up. Dark, dripping trees surrounded him. Well, there must have been something. He remembered a windmill he had seen near Hereford, with a child's red cloak caught up on one of the sails. As the sails turned, the cloak was one moment being dragged through the slush and the mud, and the next flying through the air like a vivid scarlet flag. Like an allegory of something or other. And then I can tell her about the empty village and the children at the window peeping out between the curtains, one with a doll in her hand and the other with a wooden horse. Next come the silent crowd with their weapons, and the man beneath the hedge. Oh, she was certain to say. Poor man. What happened to him? I do not know, Strange would say. But surely you stayed to help him, she would say. No, Strange would say. Oh, she would say. Wait, cried Strange, reining in his horse. This will not do at all. We must go back. I do not feel easy in my mind about the man under the hedge. Oh, cried Jeremy Johns in relief. I'm very glad to hear you say so, sir. Neither am I. I don't suppose you thought to bring a set of pistols, did you? Said Strange. No, sir. Damn, said Strange, and then flinched a little, because Miss Woodhope did not approve of oaths. What about a knife? Something of that sort? No, nothing, sir. But do not fret. Jeremy jumped up his horse and went delving about in the undergrowth. I can make us some clubs out of these branches, which will do almost as well as pistols. There were some stout branches which someone had cut from a coppice of trees and left lying on the ground. Jeremy picked up one and offered it to Strange. It was scarcely a club, more a branch with twigs growing out of it. Well, said Strange doubtfully, I suppose that is better than nothing. Jeremy equipped himself with another branch just the same, and thus armed, they rode back to the village and the silent crowd of people. You there, cried Strange, singling out a man dressed in a shepherd's smock with a number of knitted shawls tied over it and a wide-brimmed hat upon his head. He made a few flourishing gestures with his club in what he hoped was a threatening manner. What? Upon the instant, several of the crowd turned together and put their fingers to their lips. Another man came up to Strange. He was dressed rather more respectably than the first, in a coat of brown cord. He touched his fingers to his hat and said very softly, Beg pardon, sir, but could not you take the horses further off? They stamp their feet and breathe very loud. But, began Strange. Hush, sir, whispered the man. Your voice, it is too loud. You'll wake him up. Wake him up? Who? The man under the hedge, sir. He's a magician. Did you never hear that if you wake a magician before his time, you risk bringing his dreams out of his head into the world? And who knows what horrors he's dreaming of, agreed another man in a whisper. But how, began Strange. Once again, several people among the crowd turned and frowned indignantly at him and made signs that he was to speak more softly. But how do you know he's a magician? He whispered. Oh, he's been in Monk Grenton for the past 2 days, sir. He tells everyone he's a magician. On the first day, he tricked some of our children into stealing pies and beer from their mother's larders, saying that they were for the Queen of the Fairies. Yesterday, he was found wandering in the grounds of Firewater Hall, which is our great house here, sir. Mrs. Morrow, whose property it is, hired him to tell a fortune, but all he said was that her son, Captain Morrow, had been shot dead by the French. And now, poor lady, she is lain down upon her bed and says she will lie there until she dies. And so, sir, we've had enough of this man. We mean to make him go, and if he will not, we shall send him to the workhouse. Well, that seems most reasonable, whispered Strange. But what I do not understand is, just at that moment, the man under the hedge opened his eyes. The crowd gave a sort of soft communal gasp, and several people took a step or two backwards. The man extracted himself from the hedge. This was no easy task, because various parts of it, hawthorn twigs, elder branches, strands of ivy, mistletoe, and witch's broom, had insinuated themselves among his clothes, limbs, and hair during the night, or glued themselves to him with ice. He sat up. He did not seem in the least surprised to find he had an audience. Indeed, one would almost have supposed from his behavior that he'd been expecting it. He looked at them all and gave several disparaging sniffs and snorts. He ran his fingers through his hair, removed dead leaves, bits of twig, and half a dozen earwigs. I reached out my hand, he muttered to no one in particular. England's rivers turned and flowed the other way. He loosened his neckcloth and fished out some spiders which had taken up residence inside his shirt. In doing so, he revealed that his neck and throat were ornamented with an odd pattern of blue lines, dots, crosses, and circles. Then he wrapped his neckcloth back about his neck, and having thus completed his toilet to his satisfaction, he rose to his feet.
"My name is Vinculus," he declared.
Considering that he'd just spent a night under a hedge, his voice was remarkably loud and clear.
"For 10 days I have been walking westwards in search of a man who is destined to be a great magician. 10 days ago I was shown a picture of this man, and now by certain mystic signs, I see that it is you."
Everyone looked around to see who he meant. The man in the shepherd's smock and the knitted shawls came up to Strange and plucked at his coat.
"It is you, sir," he said.
"Me?" said Strange.
Vinculus approached Strange.
"Two magicians shall appear in England," he said. "The first shall fear me, the second shall long to behold me. The first shall be governed by thieves and murderers, the second shall conspire at his own destruction. The first shall bury his heart in a dark wood beneath the snow, yet still feel its ache. The second shall see his dearest possession in his enemy's hand."
"I see," interrupted Strange. "And which am I? The first or the second? No, no, do not tell me. It does not matter. Both sound entirely dreadful. For someone who is anxious that I should become a magician, I must say you do not make the life sound very appealing. I hope to be married soon, and a life spent in dark woods surrounded by thieves and murderers would be inconvenient, to say the least. I suggest you choose someone else."
"I did not choose you, magician. You were chosen long ago."
"Well, whoever it was, they will be disappointed." Vinculus ignored this remark and took a firm grasp of the bridle of Strange's horse as a precaution against his riding off. He then proceeded to recite in its entirety the prophecy which he had already performed for the benefit of Mr. Norrell in the library at Hanover Square. Strange received it with a similar degree of enthusiasm, and when it was done, he leant down from his horse and said very slowly and distinctly, "I do not know any magic." Vinculus paused. He looked as if he was prepared to concede that this might be a legitimate obstacle to Strange's becoming a great magician. Happily, the solution occurred to him immediately. He stuck his hand into the breast of his coat and pulled out some sheets of paper with bits of straw sticking to them.
"Now," he said, looking even more mysterious and impressive than before, "I have here some spells which... No, I cannot give them to you."
Strange had reached out to take them.
"They are precious objects. I endured years of torment and suffered great ordeals in order to possess them."
"How much?" said Strange.
7 shillings and 6p, said Vinculus.
"Very well. Surely you do not intend to give him any money, sir?" asked Jeremy Johns. "If it will stop him talking to me, then yes, certainly." Meanwhile, the crowd was regarding Strange and Jeremy Johns in no very friendly manner. Their appearance had coincided more or less with Vinculus's waking, and the villagers were starting to wonder if there might not be 2 apparitions from Vinculus's dreams. The villagers began to accuse one another of having woken Vinculus up. They were just starting to quarrel about it, when an official-looking person in an important-looking hat arrived and informed Vinculus that he must go to the workhouse as a pauper. Vinculus retorted that he would do no such thing, as he was not a pauper any longer. He had 7 shillings and 6p, and he dangled the money in the man's face in a very impertinent fashion. Just as a fight seemed certain to ensue from one cause or another, peace was suddenly restored to the village of Monk Gretton by the simple expedient of Vinculus turning and walking off one way, and Strange and Jeremy Johns riding off another. Towards 5 o'clock, they arrived at an inn in the village of S, near Gloucester. So little hope had Strange that his meeting with Miss Woodhope would be productive of anything but misery to them both, that he thought he would put it off until the following morning. He ordered a good dinner and went and sat down by the fire in a comfortable chair with a newspaper. But he soon discovered that comfort and tranquillity were poor substitutes for Miss Woodhope's company. And so he cancelled the dinner and went immediately to the house of Mr. and Mrs. Redmond in order to begin being unhappy as soon as possible. He found only the ladies at home, Mrs. Redmond and Miss Woodhope. Lovers are rarely the most rational beings in creation, and so it will come as no surprise to my readers to discover that Strange's musings concerning Miss Woodhope had produced a most inexact portrait of her. Though his imaginary conversations might be said to describe her opinions, they were no guide at all to her disposition and manners. It was not her habit to harass recently bereaved persons with demands that they build schools and almshouses, nor did she find fault with everything they said. She was not so unnatural. She greeted him in a very different manner from the cross, scolding young lady of his imaginings. Far from demanding that he immediately undo every wrong his father had ever done, she behaved with particular kindness towards him, and seemed altogether delighted to see him. She was about 22 years of age. In repose, her looks were only moderately pretty. There was very little about her face and figure that was in any way remarkable, but it was the sort of face which, when animated by conversation or laughter, is completely transformed. She had a lively disposition, a quick mind, and a fondness for the comical. She was always very ready to smile, and since a smile is the most becoming ornament that any lady can wear, she had been known upon occasion to outshine women who were acknowledged beauties in three counties. Her friend, Mrs. Redmond, was a kindly, placid creature of 45. She was not rich, widely travelled, or particularly clever. Under other circumstances, she would have been puzzled to know what to say to a man of the world like Jonathan Strange. But happily, his father had just died, and that provided a subject.
"I dare say you're a great deal occupied just now, Mr. Strange," she said. "I remember when my own father died. There was a world of things to do. He left so many bequests. There were some china jugs that used to stand upon the kitchen mantelpiece at home. My father wished a jug to be given to each of our old servants. But the descriptions of the jugs in his will were most confusing, and no one could tell which jug was meant for which person. And then the servants quarrelled, and they all desired to be given the yellow jug with pink roses. Oh, I thought I would never be done with those bequests. Did your father leave many bequests, Mr. Strange?"
"No, madam, none. He hated everybody."
"Ah, that is fortunate, is it not? And what shall you do now?"
"Do," echoed Mr. Strange.
"Miss Woodhope says your poor dear father bought and sold things. Shall you do the same?"
"No, madam. If I have my way, and I believe I shall, my father's business will all be wound up as soon as possible."
"Oh, but then I dare say you will be a good deal taken up with farming. Miss Woodhope says your estate is a large one."
"It is, madam. But I have tried farming, and I find it does not suit me."
"Ah,"
said Mrs. Redmond wisely. There was a silence. Mrs. Redmond's clock ticked, and the coals shifted in the grate. Mrs. Redmond began to pull about some embroidery silks that lay in her lap, and it got into a fearful knot. Then her black cat mistook this activity for a game and stalked along the sofa and tried to catch at the silks. Arabella laughed and caught up the cat and started to play with it. This was exactly the sort of tranquil domestic scene that Strange had set his heart upon, though he did not want Mrs. Redmond and was undecided about the cat. And it was all the more desirable in his eyes, since he had never met with anything other than coldness and disagreeableness in his childhood home. The question was how to persuade Arabella that it was what she wanted too. A sort of inspiration came over him, and he suddenly addressed Mrs. Redmond again. "In short, madam, I do not think that I shall have the time. I am going to study magic."
"Magic!"
exclaimed Arabella, looking at him in surprise. She seemed about to question him further, but at this highly interesting moment, Mr. Redmond was heard in the hall. He was accompanied by his curate, Henry Woodhope, the same Henry Woodhope who was both brother to Arabella and childhood friend to Jonathan Strange. Naturally, there were introductions and explanations to get through. Henry Woodhope had not known Strange was coming, and for the moment, Strange's unexpected announcement was forgotten. The gentlemen were just come from a parish meeting, and as soon as everyone was seated again in the drawing-room, Mr. Redmond and Henry imparted various items of parish news to Mrs. Redmond and Arabella. And then they inquired about Strange's journey, the state of the roads, and how the farmers got on in Shropshire, Herefordshire, and Gloucestershire, these being the counties Strange had travelled through. At 7 o'clock, the tea-things were brought in. In the silence that followed, while they were all eating and drinking, Mrs. Redmond remarked to her husband, Mr. Strange is going to be a magician, my love. She spoke as if it were the most natural thing in the world, because to her it was.
A magician? Said Henry, quite astonished.
Why should you want to do that? Strange paused. He did not wish to tell his real reason, which was to impress Arabella with his determination to do something sober and scholarly. And so he fell back upon the only other explanation he could think of. I met a man under a hedge at Monk Gretton who told me that I was a magician. Mr. Redman laughed, approving the joke.
Excellent, he said.
Did you indeed? Said Mrs. Redmond.
I do not understand, said Henry Woodhope.
You do not believe me, I suppose, said Strange to Arabella.
Oh, on the contrary, Mr. Strange, said Arabella, with an amused smile. It is all of a piece with your usual way of doing things. It is quite as strong a foundation for a career as I should expect from you.
Henry said, But if you're going to take up a profession, and I cannot see why you should want one at all, now that you have come into your property, surely you can choose something better than magic. It has no practical application.
No, but I think you're wrong, said Mr. Redmond.
There is that gentleman in London who confounds the French by sending them illusions. I forget his name. What is it that he calls his theory? Modern magic?
But how is that different from the old-fashioned sort? Wondered Mrs. Redmond.
And which will you do, Mr. Strange?
Yes. Do tell us, Mr. Strange, said Arabella with an arch look. Which will you do?
A little of both, Miss Woodhope.
A little of both.
Turning to Mrs. Redmond, he said, I purchased 3 spells from the man under the hedge. Should you like to see one, madam?
Oh, yes, indeed.
Miss Woodhope? Asked Strange.
What are they for?
I do not know. I have not read them yet.
Jonathan Strange took the 3 spells Vinculus had given him out of his breast pocket and gave them to her to look at.
They're very dirty, said Arabella.
Oh, we magicians do not regard a little dirt. Besides, I dare say they're very old. Ancient, mysterious spells such as these are often...
The date is written at the top of them. 2nd of February, 1808. That is 2 weeks ago.
Indeed. I'd not observed.
2 spells to make an obstinate man leave London, read Arabella. I wonder why the magician would want to make people leave London.
I do not know. There are certainly too many people in London, but it seems a great deal of work to make them leave one at a time.
But these are horrible, full of ghosts and horrors, making them think that they're about to meet their one true love, when in truth the spell does nothing of the sort.
Let me see. Strange snatched back the offending spells. He examined them rapidly and said, I promise you, I knew nothing of their content when I purchased them, and nothing whatsoever. The truth is that the man I bought them from was a vagabond and quite destitute. With the money I gave him, he was able to escape the workhouse.
Well, I'm glad of that. But his spells are still horrible, and I hope you will not use them.
But what of the last spell? One spell to discover what my enemy is doing presently.
I think you can have no objection to that.
Let me do the last spell.
But will it work?
You do not have any enemies, do you?
None that I know of, and so there can be no harm in attempting it.
Can there?
The instructions called for a mirror and some dead flowers. Footnote 3. Mr. Norrell appears to have adapted it from a description of a Lancashire spell in Peter Watership's Death's Library, 1448. Strange and Henry lifted a mirror off the wall and laid it upon the table. The flowers were more difficult. It was February, and the only flowers Mrs. Redmond possessed were some dried lavender, roses, and thyme.
Will these do? She asked Strange.
He shrugged.
Who knows?
Now, he studied the instructions again. The flowers must be placed around, like so, and then I draw a circle upon the mirror with my finger, like this, and quarter the circle. Strike the mirror thrice, and say these words.
Strange, said Henry Woodhope. Where did you get this nonsense?
From the man under the hedge, Henry. You do not listen.
And he seemed honest, did he?
Honest? No, not particularly. He seemed, I would say, cold.
Yes, cold is a good word to describe him, and hungry another.
And how much did you pay for these spells?
Henry, said his sister, did you not just hear Mr. Strange say that he bought them as an act of charity?
Strange was absent-mindedly drawing circles upon the surface of the mirror and quartering them.
Arabella, who was sitting next to him, gave a sudden start of surprise.
Strange looked down.
Good God! He cried.
In the mirror was the image of a room, but it was not Mrs. Redmond's drawing room. It was a small room, furnished not extravagantly, but very well. The ceiling, which was high, gave the idea of its being a small apartment within a large and perhaps rather grand house. There were bookcases full of books, and other books lay about on tables. There was a good fire in the fireplace, and candles on the desk. A man worked at a desk. He was perhaps 50 and dressed very plainly in a grey coat. He was a quiet, unremarkable sort of a man in an old-fashioned wig. Several books lay open on his desk, and he read a little in some and wrote a little in others.
"Mrs. Redmond, Henry," cried Arabella, "come quickly, see what Mr. Strange has done."
"But who in the world is he?" asked Strange, mystified. He lifted the mirror and looked under it, apparently with the idea that he might discover there a tiny gentleman in a grey coat ready to be questioned. When the mirror was replaced upon the table, the vision of the other room and the other man was still there. They could hear no sounds from the other room, but the flames of the fire danced in the grate, and the man with his glinting spectacles on his nose turned his head from one book to another.
"Why is he your enemy?" asked Arabella.
"I have not the least idea."
"Do you owe him money, perhaps?" asked Mr. Redmond.
"I do not think so."
"He could be a banker."
"It looks a little like a counting house," suggested Arabella. Strange began to laugh.
"Well, Henry, you can cease frowning at me. If I am a magician, I'm a very indifferent one. Other adepts summon up fairy spirits and long-dead kings. I appear to have conjured the spirit of a banker."
Volume 2. Jonathan Strange.
"Can a magician kill a man by magic?" Lord Wellington asked Strange.
Strange frowned. He seemed to dislike the question.
"I suppose a magician might," he admitted.
"But a gentleman never could."
Chapter 23. The Shadow House. July 1809.
On a summer's day in 1809, two riders were travelling along a dusty country lane in Wiltshire. The sky was of a deep, brilliant blue, and beneath it, England lay sketched in deep shadows and in hazy reflections of the sky's fierce light. A great horse chestnut leant over the road and made a pool of black shadow, and when the two riders reached the shadow, it swallowed them up so that nothing remained of them except their voices.
"And how long will it be before you consider publication?" said one. "For you must, you know. I've been considering the matter, and I believe it is the first duty of every modern magician to publish. I'm surprised Norrell does not publish."
"I dare say he will in time," said the other. "As to my publishing, who would wish to read what I have written? These days, when Norrell performs a new miracle every week, I cannot suppose that the work of a purely theoretical magician would be of much interest to anybody."
"Oh, you're too modest," said the first voice. "You must not leave everything to Norrell. Norrell cannot do everything."
"But he can. He does," sighed the second voice.
How pleasant to meet old friends. For it is Mr. Honeyfoot and Mr. Segundus. Yet why do we find them on horseback? A kind of exercise which agrees with neither of them, and which neither takes regularly. Mr. Honeyfoot being too old, and Mr. Segundus too poor. And on such a day as this, so hot that it will make Mr. Honeyfoot first sweat, and then itch, and then break out in red pimples. A day of such dazzling brightness that it is certain to bring on one of Mr. Segundus's headaches. And what are they doing in Wiltshire? It had so happened that in the course of his labours, on behalf of the little stone figure and the girl with the ivy leaves in her hair, Mr. Honeyfoot had discovered something. He believed that he had identified the murderer as an Avebury man. So he had come to Wiltshire to look at some old documents in Avebury Parish Church. "For,"
as he had explained to Mr. Segundus. If I discover who he was, then perhaps it may lead me to discover who was the girl, and what dark impulse drove him to destroy her.
Mr. Segundus had gone with his friend, and had looked at all the documents, and helped him unpick the old Latin. But though Mr. Segundus loved old documents, no one loved them more, and though he put great faith in what they could achieve, he secretly doubted that 7 Latin words, 5 centuries old, could explain a man's life. But Mr. Honeyfoot was all optimism. Then it occurred to Mr. Segundus that, as they were already in Wiltshire, they should take the opportunity to visit the Shadow House, which stood in that county and which neither of them had ever seen. Most of us remember hearing of the Shadow House in our schoolrooms. The name conjures up vague notions of magic and ruins, yet few of us have any very clear recollection of why it is so important. The truth is that historians of magic still argue over its significance, and some will be quick to tell you that it is of no significance whatsoever. No great events in English magical history took place there. Furthermore, of the 2 magicians who lived in the house, one was a charlatan and the other was a woman. Neither a tribute likely to recommend its possessor to the gentlemen magicians and gentlemen historians of recent years. And yet, for 2 centuries, the Shadow House has been known as one of the most magical places in England. It was built in the 16th century by Gregory Absalom, court magician to King Henry VIII and to Queens Mary and Elizabeth. If we measure a magician's success by how much magic he does, then Absalom was no magician at all, for his spells hardly ever took effect. However, if instead we examine the amount of money a magician makes and allow that to be our yardstick, then Absalom was certainly one of the greatest English magicians who ever lived, for he was born in poverty and died a very rich man. One of his boldest achievements was to persuade the King of Denmark to pay a great handful of diamonds for a spell which, Absalom claimed, would turn the flesh of the King of Sweden into water. Naturally, the spell did nothing of the sort, but with the money he got for half these jewels, Absalom built the Shadow House. He furnished it with Turkey carpets and Venetian mirrors and glass and 100 other beautiful things. And when the house was completed, a curious thing happened, or may have happened, or did not happen at all. Some scholars believe, and others do not, that the magic which Absalom had pretended to do for his clients began to appear of its own accord in the house. On a moonlit night in 1610, 2 maids looked out of a window on an upper floor and saw 20 or 30 beautiful ladies and handsome gentlemen dancing in a circle on the lawn. In February 1666, Valentine Greatrex, an Irishman, held a conversation in Hebrew with the prophets Moses and Aaron in a little passageway near the great linen press. In 1667, Mrs. Penelope Chell Morton, a visitor to the house, looked in a mirror and saw a little girl of 3 or 4 years old looking out. As she watched, she saw the child grow up and grow older, and she recognized herself. Mrs. Chelmorton's reflection continued to age until there was naught but a dry, dead corpse in the mirror. The reputation of the Shadow House is based upon these and 100 other such tales. Absalom had 1 child, a daughter named Maria. She was born in the Shadow House and lived there all her life, scarcely ever leaving it for more than a day or two. In her youth, the house was visited by kings and ambassadors, by scholars, soldiers, and poets. Even after the death of her father, people came to look upon the end of English magic, its last strange flowering on the eve of its long winter. Then, as the visitors became fewer, the house weakened and began to decay, and the garden went to the wild. But Maria Absalom refused to repair her father's house. Even dishes that broke were left in cracked pieces on the floor. Footnote 1. Some scholars, Jonathan Strange among them, have argued that Maria Absalom knew exactly what she was about when she permitted her house to go to rack and ruin. It is their contention that Miss Absalom did what she did in accordance with the commonly held belief that all ruined buildings belong to the Raven King. This presumably would account for the fact that the magic at the Shadow House appeared to grow stronger after the house fell into ruin. All of man's works, all his cities, all his empires, all his monuments, will one day crumble to dust.
Even the houses of my own dear readers must, though it be for just one day, one hour, be ruined, and become houses where the stones are mortared with moonlight, windowed with starlight, and furnished with the dusty wind. It is said that in that day, in that hour, our houses become the possessions of the Raven King. Though we bewail the end of English magic, and say it is long gone from us, and inquire of each other how it was possible that we came to lose something so precious, let us not forget that it also waits for us at England's end, and one day we will no more be able to escape the Raven King than in this present age we can bring him back. The History and Practice of English Magic by Jonathan Strange, publisher John Murray, London, 1816. In her 50th year, the ivy was grown so vigorous and had so far extended itself that it grew inside all the closets and made much of the floor slippery and unsafe to walk upon. Birds sang as much within the house as without. In her 100th year, the house and the woman were ruinous together, though neither was at all extinguished. She continued another 49 years, before dying one summer morning in her bed, with the leaf shadows of a great ash tree and the broken sunlight falling all around her. As Mr. Honeyfoot and Mr. Segundus hurried towards the shadow house on this hot afternoon, they were a little nervous, in case Mr. Norrell should get to hear of their going. For what with admirals and ministers sending him respectful letters and paying him visits, Mr. Norrell was growing greater by the hour. They feared lest he should consider that Mr. Honeyfoot had broken the terms of his contract. So in order that as few people as possible should know what they were about, they had told no one where they were going, and had set off very early in the morning, and had walked to a farm where they could hire horses, and had come to the shadow house by a very roundabout way. At the end of the dusty white lane, they came to a pair of high gates. Mr. Segundus got down from his horse to open them. The gates had been made of fine Castilian wrought iron, but were now rusted to a dark, vivid red, and their original form was very much decayed and shriveled. Mr. Segundus's hand came away with dusty traces upon it, as if a million dried and powdered roses had been compacted and formed into the dreamlike semblance of a gate. The curling iron had been further ornamented with little bas-reliefs of wicked, laughing faces, now ember-red and disintegrating, as if the part of hell where these heathens were now resident was in the charge of an inattentive demon who had allowed his furnace to get too hot. Beyond the gate were 1,000 pale pink roses, and high, nodding cliffs of sunlit elm and ash and chestnut, and the blue, blue sky. There were 4 tall gables, and a multitude of high grey chimneys and stone latticed windows. But the shadow house had been a ruined house for well over a century, and was built as much of elder trees and dog roses as of silvery limestone, and had in its composition as much of summer-scented breezes as of iron and timber.
"It is like the other lands," said Mr. Segundus, pressing his face into the gate in his enthusiasm, and receiving from it an impression of its shape, apparently in powdered roses.
Footnote 2. When people talk of the other lands, they generally have in mind fairy, or some such other vague notion. For the purposes of general conversation, such definitions do very well, but a magician must learn to be more precise. It is well known that the Raven King ruled 3 kingdoms. The first was the kingdom of northern England, that encompassed Cumberland, Northumberland, Durham, Yorkshire, Lancashire, Derbyshire, and part of Nottinghamshire. The other 2 were called the King's Other Lands. One was part of Faerie, and the other was commonly supposed to be a country on the far side of hell, sometimes called the Bitter Lands. The king's enemies said that he leased it from Lucifer. He pulled open the gate and led in his horse. Mr. Honeyfoot followed. They tied up their horses by a stone basin and began to explore the gardens. The grounds of the shadow house did not perhaps deserve the name gardens. No one had tended them for over 100 years, but nor were they a wood or a wilderness. There is no word in the English language for a magician's garden 200 years after the magician is dead. It was richer and more disordered than any garden Mr. Secundus and Mr. Honeyfoot had ever seen before. Mr. Honeyfoot was highly delighted with everything he saw. He exclaimed over a great avenue of elms, where the trees stood almost to their waists, as it were, in a sea of vivid pink foxgloves. He wondered aloud over a carving of a fox which carried a baby in its mouth. He spoke cheerfully of the remarkable magical atmosphere of the place, and declared that even Mr. Norrell might learn something by coming here. But Mr. Honeyfoot was not really very susceptible to atmospheres. Mr. Segundus, on the other hand, began to feel uneasy. It seemed to him that Absalom's garden was exerting a strange kind of influence on him. Several times, as Mr. Honeyfoot and he walked about, he found himself on the point of speaking to someone he thought he knew, or of recognizing a place he had known before. But each time, just as he was about to remember what he wanted to say, he realized that what he had taken for a friend was in fact only a shadow on the surface of a rosebush. The man's head was only a spray of pale roses, and his hand another. The place that Mr. Segundus thought he knew as well as the common scenes of childhood was only a chance conjunction of a yellow bush, some swaying elder branches, and the sharp sunlit corner of the house. Besides, he could not think who was the friend or what was the place. This began to disturb him so much that after half an hour he proposed to Mr. Honeyfoot that they sit for a while.
"My dear friend," said Mr. Honeyfoot, "what is the matter? Are you ill? You're very pale. Your hand is trembling. Why did you not speak sooner?"
Mr. Segundus passed his hand across his head and said somewhat indistinctly that he believed that some magic was about to take place. He had a most definite impression that that was the case.
"Magic!" exclaimed Mr. Honeyfoot. "But what magic could there be?"
He looked about him nervously, in case Mr. Norrell should appear suddenly from behind a tree.
"I dare say it is nothing more than the heat of the day which afflicts you. I myself am very hot, but we are blockheads to remain in this condition, for here is comfort, here is refreshment. To sit in the shade of tall trees such as these, by a sweet chattering brook such as this, is generally allowed to be the best restorative in the world. Come, Mr. Segundus, let us sit down."
They sat down upon the grassy bank of a brown stream. The warm, soft air and the scent of roses calmed and soothed Mr. Segundus. His eyes closed once, opened, closed again, opened slowly and heavily. He began to dream almost immediately. He saw a tall doorway in a dark place. It was carved from a silver-grey stone that shone a little as if there was moonlight. The doorposts were made in the likeness of two men, or it might only be one man, for both were the same. The man seemed to stride out of the wall, and John Segundus knew him at once for a magician. The face could not clearly be seen, only enough to know that it would be a young face and a handsome one. Upon his head he wore a cap with a sharp peak, and raven wings upon each side. John Segundus passed through the door, and for a moment saw only the black sky and the stars and the wind. But then he saw that there was indeed a room, but that it was ruinous. Yet despite this, such walls as there were furnished with pictures, tapestries, and mirrors. But the figures in the tapestries moved about and spoke to each other, and not all the mirrors gave faithful reproductions of the room. Some seemed to reflect other places entirely. At the far end of the room, in an uncertain compound of moonlight and candlelight, someone was sitting at a table. She wore a gown of a very ancient style, and of a greater quality of material than John Segundus could have supposed necessary or even possible in one garment. It was of a strange old rich blue, and about the gown, like other stars, the last of the King of Denmark's diamonds were shining still. She looked up at him as he approached, two curiously slanting eyes set farther apart than is generally considered correct for beauty, and a long mouth curved into a smile, the meaning of which he could not guess at. Flickers of candlelight suggested hair as red as her dress was blue. Suddenly, another person arrived in John Segundus's dream, a gentleman dressed in modern clothes. This gentleman did not appear at all surprised at the finely dressed but somewhat outmoded lady. But he did appear very astonished to find John Segundus there, and he reached out his hand and took John Segundus by the shoulder and began to shake him. Mr. Segundus found that Mr. Honeyfoot had grasped his shoulder and was gently shaking him.
"I beg your pardon," said Mr. Honeyfoot,
But you cried out in your sleep, and I thought perhaps you would wish to be woken.
Mr. Segundus looked at him in some perplexity.
I had a dream, he said. A most curious dream.